Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. You're listening to NPR News. I'm Tiffany Hansen in for Carrie Miller. Regardless of your political stripe, I think and hope, actually, that there's still a few things we can agree on, one of which is that we are living in a very divisive time. How we got here and whose fault it is are completely up for debate, but here we are. I think we can also agree that it's not the media or journalists' job to either repair the schism or fan the flames of discontent. Our job in the media is, in part, to report the facts, to give voice to people who may or may not agree with one another, to foster participation in our democracy, and examine our government. It's not a popularity contest or ratings contest, or at least it shouldn't be, in my opinion. It is a mandate from our founding fathers to maintain a free press. Still, it is worthwhile to ask, how does the media maintain its core values and also acknowledge that the current political climate and social climate requires some adaptation? With me today are two journalists who have thought a lot about this question and many others, I'm sure, around journalism's role in a free society. Jay Rosen joins me, journalism professor and director of the Studio 20 program at NYU. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning, Tiffany.
And Mia Parrish, former publisher of the Arizona Republic and the Kansas City Star, who is currently teaching at Arizona State University. Good morning, Mia.
Good morning, Tiffany.
And of course, we need you in this conversation. How should media adapt to the current divisive climate without succumbing to it on one hand or ignoring it on the other? Call me, 800-242-2828 or 651-227-6000. And you can find me on Twitter at Tiffany Hansen, two S's E-N. Jay, sort of what got us started thinking about this show is a great Twitter thread that you have that brings up many facets of this conundrum that journalists are, that we are finding ourselves in. And the first thing I want to touch on from that thread is the notion of an agenda. You said that one of the main things that newsrooms need to do is have a firm grasp of their agenda. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that Trump is like a hurricane of news. And he says so many controversial things and so many things that are untrue and launches so many attacks on the news media that you can get very caught up in his whirlwind if you don't have a firm grasp on some of your own priorities. If you don't have a clear agenda of your own, you'll get swept away by his agenda, which is chaos, noise, attack, divisiveness, polarization, and everything else that you just mentioned. So in order for the press to have that kind of agenda, they have to get it from somewhere. They shouldn't be getting it, as you mentioned in your intro, from their own ideology or their political preferences. It really has to come from the voters, from the listeners, from the people that they're reporting to. And so when I refer to an agenda, I mean a civic agenda, the agenda that citizens have for what they want the discussion to be. And in, without that, you are victim to this cycle of chaos and divisiveness.
I think when people hear the word agenda, sometimes they will jump to the conclusion that you have a political agenda or so. Is I just wonder, is agenda the right word, I guess?
Well, I'm a writer. I'm trying to arrest your attention. I'm trying to make you think about something. And so the fact that people are alert to that word is not necessarily a bad thing. It's that causes them to look a little bit closer at what I'm saying. But I'm well aware that people freak out over the word agenda.
Yeah. Mia, in Jay's talking about us understanding who our constituency is, in parts of the country that really support President Trump's agenda and his style, how do we do what Jay is asking us to do, considering your audience, the voters as a constituency, while still calling out inaccuracies, untruths, that sort of thing?
Right. I like to think of it as journalistic purpose. To argue, I think Jay and I have a similar point of view in terms of that, where what is the purpose of that story? What is the purpose of your point as, you know, what you cover, what you emphasize? Because as we were saying, you know, it used to be that you have a news cycle that lasts a week, and now you have one that could last a half an hour. So, you know, you're constantly prioritizing, and that prioritization does start with those basic goals of, you know, that civic agenda of informing and enlightening and holding the powerful accountable. It's just become increasingly exhausting in this environment. So we have to be even more vigilant. You mentioned that it isn't our job to fix it, but I do think we have a role in it.
Yeah, Jay, what is our role in shaping our future and shaping the future of the democracy, even if we dare be so lofty?
Well, I think the main thing we need journalists to do is help create an informed public by letting us know what's going on. But in addition to that, I think it's important for the press to – I don't know why that's ringing. I think it's important for the press to –
They have a question.
to protect democratic institutions, of which the free press is one. And when you have a president who is intent on eroding trust in basic democratic institutions like the press, but also free elections, which he's called rigged, the intelligence community, which he's called corrupt, the press has a duty to let Americans know that their institutions are under threat. That is part of a watchdog press.
Mia, I think that we are in the process of becoming a more pluralistic, multiracial, multicultural democracy. If we consider those aspects, what does that do for the future of journalism? Are we just in a growing pain phase for journalism and our democracy simultaneously?
Yes.
Yeah.
We are growing in a growing pain phase, certainly, and it's not the first time that the press has been under threat, but our credibility has never been so low. And the weaponization of the information has become so intense, and that's accelerated in, you know, even in recent years. And growing pains, I think, is probably a light way of putting it. You know, we're in a very disrupted space, in a very dangerous time. And those democratic institutions, I do think we do have a responsibility. We're part of that. We're part of the social fabric. So while, you know, there are growing pains, I think we haven't seen anything quite like this. And we continue to figure out how to evolve, adapt, revolutionize how we approach it.
Dan on Twitter says, journalists must forget about access and appease the interviewer. And appeasing the interviewer. Instead, they should focus on holding them accountable because journalists are one of the few who can. Only allow guests who operate in good faith and challenge those who try to lie about it or obfuscate the issues. Jody says, I would think the same as in non-divisive times with objectivity, appropriateness, and relevance, objectivity being the biggest, which we see very little of right now. And I'd like to go to the phones to Melody in Coon Rapids. Good morning, Melody.
Good morning.
So you teach journalism.
I do. And so my students this semester were in week two. They've already expressed their distaste with the biased news sources that they're mostly watching. So I think they're talking a lot about cable news. But we also talk about kind of how impossible objectivity can be for reporters, right? So we all come to the table with our own personal perspectives. And I think students, what I'm thinking they're getting at is that if the news sources could just be more upfront about their angle, right? So, like Democracy Now, NPR, if there is an angle, just be upfront about it. And also, another thing that I talked to them about is media literacy skills. So it doesn't matter what news source you're looking at, really look at who the author is, what sources they're using, what the original news source, what credibility they have, right? So I am also sensing in the classroom some disdain for the biased and divisive media. So I'm trying to get them to think more about media literacy skills.
Jay?
Well, it certainly is true that we need people to be on their guard. We need people who are literate in how media works. We have to teach citizens to be both skeptical and adept at finding the information they need. And one of the reasons for that is that the free press clause, which you mentioned in your opening, Tiffany, not only applies to journalists and their struggle to report the news, but it really belongs to every citizen in the United States. The Free Press Clause says you are free to write down what you think and publish it if you can to other people. And in an age of Facebook and Twitter and social media, everybody is exercising the rights of a free press. And that's especially why we need media literacy, but we also need the people in the media to be literate about the kind of political developments that are overtaking American democracy.
We've had, at least I have in my own head, had thoughts about media reporting both sides of the story. Mia, we say, how can we present both sides of the story if, for example, it's something like, you know, the Earth revolves around the sun and here's how we know that, but scientist B over here says the Earth is flat and here's why. Do you get where I'm going with this? How do you present both sides of the story if the initial premise is not really up for debate?
Right. We have we've really been caught in this both-siderism, you know, which is part of our idea of being neutral or not biased, that the answer to that is, well, person A says this and person B says that. Go figure it out. And that's dangerous. I mean, I don't think it's realistic to say, you know, Hitler said this, Churchill said that. Go figure it out. No, Hitler said this and he's super evil and Churchill said that and he's not evil. He has anger management issues and sometimes, you know, says grumpy things. You know, it's up to us to provide that context. It is incumbent upon us to make smart decisions and dangerous when we don't, especially nowadays. You know, we really fell into that idea that we would just let everybody have a say and have it be an equal bullhorn because we're really loath to start making those choices because it's easier to not make any sort of choice.
I'd like to go to Josh in St. Mary's Point. Good morning, Josh.
Hi. Yeah, this really echoes a lot of my points. And we've got journalists in the immediate family, and I've had versions of this conversation with a couple of friends who are also journalists. And it's more the nature, it's exactly what you were just touching on with being that there's never any excuse to abandon critical reason and go to facts and go to double-checking and verifying things. It's something that I specifically have noticed more frequently from National Public Radio recently, where, frankly, a couple of friends of mine have made comments about it as playing, quote, footsie with fascists, where in the interest of giving other points of view and a diverse points of view, there are statements that are easily verifiable as completely factually inaccurate and manipulative information that is just kind of glossed through in a word salad interview or in a fluff piece with someone. And that disquiets me. Mm. I feel that I value lots of points of view to test myself against and to test others. And I'll Snopes myself and Snopes some things that I frankly agree with to see if they're accurate because I take that seriously. And I am noticing more and more, it could be somewhat subjective, that I'm not seeing that as readily, or I am seeing things that are factually accurate dismissively written off as, oh, that's MSNBC's skewed perspective, or, oh, that's this or this skewed perspective, where these things are really easy to verify the credibility of the information and parse out what is opinion and what is actual fact. And when there's an overall assault on truth, to not call that out and to not back that out is really abrogating your responsibility as a free press.
So, Jay, Josh is obviously a very savvy media consumer, news consumer, but he brings up the point we are at a risk, we journalists are at a risk of being complicit a little bit if we're not careful. Do you agree with that?
Well, yes, I do, and I've made that criticism myself in a variety of ways. I think we should step back and look at what's going on here, though. Glenn Kessler, who is the Washington Post fact checker, made this observation about President Trump and what makes him different from other politicians. He said that Democratic and Republican presidents and candidates have always reacted more or less in the same way when they were fact-checked by the press and found to be saying something that was untrue. They would change the claim so that it was more or less correct, or they would stop saying that, or they would remove it from their stump speech. They would react somehow to the fact-check so that they weren't continually in violation, so to speak. And he observed this behavior over decades and in both parties. President Trump has a different attitude. When he is fact-checked, he doubles down, triples down. He sometimes makes the claim worse. And he continually will cite something that has been fact-checked and shown to be false many, many times. So obviously, saying things that are untrue is part of his political style, but also incorporated into that style is that when the press reacts to that and said, he said something again that was false, his base interprets that as journalists attacking him, which is an advantage to him. So this is a method of governance that he's developed by flooding the news system with stuff that is untrue and almost impossible to ignore, and then benefiting from the reactions that that behavior inevitably produces. We've had 3 or 4 years of it, of this by now, and journalists still haven't figured out what to do.
Yeah. If you have some ideas about what journalists should be doing, you can call me 800-242-2828 or 651-227-6000. And I'm on Twitter at Tiffany Hansen with two S's, E-N. Mia, I'm wondering about, we talk about our role and how it's changing. And one thing that I've noticed is that we come across this language of belief in facts. And that somehow a fact is open to interpretation. How can we get to the point that a fact is a fact?
Well, your guess is as good as mine at this point. I used to believe, you know, a couple years ago very strongly, and if you tell the truth, if you state a fact, then that will win. You know, that's the end of the story in terms of the argument. And I've come to believe that I'm naive. And as Jay was saying, we're living in a very different environment, and we weren't prepared for that. We were used to fact-checking and having, you know, politicians lie, right? We're accustomed to that, but we were not accustomed to them not correcting or course-correcting in that. And that's been monumentally difficult to deal with.
I want to play a bite that I have here from Kellyanne Conway, one of President Trump's advisors.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered.
Hey, Chuck,
Zeke Miller, four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts.
Jay, I'm sure you probably remember that interview with Chuck Todd and Kellyanne Conway. What was your first reaction to that?
I thought she was being very candid. President Trump was attempting to replace himself, when it was substitute himself for a diet of independent fact. The striking thing about his relationship to his supporters is that about one-third of the public has, in effect, exited from the news system. And the main source of information about Trump is President Trump. Now, that is an authoritarian news system that is up and running for about 30 to 35% of the American public. That itself is a crisis of democracy. And our press certainly hasn't figured out what to do about that because every time they try and strike a blow for truth and accuracy, they are actually functioning as a hate object for the president of the United States. And I think one more point here is we have to confront the startling fact – I'm going to say it slowly so to, you absorb it – that the most potent force for misinforming the American public is the president of the United States. That is an unprecedented situation.
Mia, we have a hard time getting people to, quote unquote, believe our facts. And some of that may or may not come down to propaganda. And I'm wondering if you agree with that. You know, we have folks that think all liberals hate America or that all conservatives are racist. And no matter what they say, if it's a fact or not, I don't believe it.
Yes, I agree. We've had I have a lot of educated, interesting people who will just say, I throw my hands up. I can't tell who's telling the truth. There's such an exhaustion around that. And as Jay said, a tremendous danger because it's already happened and it happened almost without us realizing it was being taken away from us because we were so clear on the idea that we could take the high road, tell the truth, state the facts. But the way – the nature of both the news cycle and the way that the platforms have worked and the that we are seeing that it's so easy to tune out. It's so easy to find an echo chamber where people agree with you no matter what – how crazy the thing is that you believe or that you've heard. You can find something to reinforce that. And that's very comforting to people, you know, when they're being attacked because the president has found a common enemy and it is us.
Mm-hmm. Doug on Twitter says, true journalism is based on facts, context, and relevance. My worry is others try to make the news by manipulating what should be the story. Real news has layers. Keep peeling away to reveal the truth. If you want to reach me on Twitter, you can at Tiffany Hansen, 2SZN. And of course, we'll take more calls coming up 800-242-2828 or 651-227-6000. We're going to take a quick break for news. All right, we're back now with our conversation about journalism and its changing role in this very divisive climate we have. I have a lot of folks on Twitter. David, the conservative, says, try reporting facts, not you or your employer's bias. Ed said, stop both sidesing climate change, fascism, police violence for the sake of fake objectivity. Stop taking funding from the fossil fuel industry. Stop taking cops at their word. Smiles says, what I think the press could do to combat Trump is to ignore him and simply report what policy he is changing, etc. And I do hope to get back to that, actually, to that question with our guests, Jay Rosen from NYU and Mia Parrish. But first, you know, we as journalists spend a lot of time talking about how other people do their jobs or don't do their jobs. So we don't often do a good job of explaining our own process. And so I've asked Nancy Cassett, the executive director of news and programming here at NPR, to join us for just a few minutes to talk about our process here in the building. I think for our listeners, it would be hard to hear the conversation that we've been having without wondering about what we do right here in this building. What, Nancy, first of all, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
And second, what is your reaction to what you've heard so far?
Well, my first reaction is that it's been kind of a depressing conversation. But
in what way?
Well, the idea that it feels like listening to Mia and to Jay just talk about that there may just be no way out at this point. But then sort of as I was walking into the studio, what came to mind is that actually It's hard being a journalist these days, but it's also hard being a news consumer. That being a news consumer is work, because you need to really work to kind of dig up the news, and you have to, you really have to be fastidious about what you're reading.
Mm-hmm. We have, I think we've touched on a lot in this first part of the conversation. We have an obligation as journalists. I think most people who come into this profession definitely feel that obligation, and particularly, I think, in public radio, because we are public radio. What sense of obligation do you have that sort of guides our principles every day? And has that changed as our political climate, our social climate has gotten more divisive?
For sure. I would say covering President Trump has been really a change for me as a news leader. And let me explain that a little bit, because I'm actually happy to be here to talk to the audience about this, because giving you an insight into what our thought process is, which it has been pretty extensive, is crucial. And one of the things we think about, first of all, so Minnesota is in one of those, I'll call battleground, potential swing states. And so we are seeing a lot of politicians come through here. You know, our day-to-day coverage doesn't really include President Trump as a NPR newsroom, per se. However, since I said we are in a battleground state, he is coming here, Democratic candidates are coming here, and what we think about is we are serving a statewide audience. And that means that we are a public service to the statewide audience. And in some parts of the state, there isn't access to broadband. I mean, if you take this back to just being a utility, we are a radio station that serves the state. So when your president comes to town, should you have access to what he says? If you can't get it via your internet or your phone, if you can't afford a phone. So the public service piece for NPR News really comes into play. Now, what you do with your live airwaves is the next layer that we kind of have created some guardrails around when we decide we're going to take President Trump live on our air and when we are not. And we are going to be the journalists as opposed to being the utility.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about divisive figures, as I think pretty much everybody would agree, President Trump is a divisive figure in American politics right now. We had Bernie Sanders on at the fair. We had Ilhan Omar on our airwaves with Angela, who was just in here. Ilhan Omar is, of course, representing her district here in Minnesota. We have an obligation, I think, to inform her constituents, our listeners, how she's doing her job. On the other hand, she's also one of the most divisive figures in American politics today, right here from Minnesota. What goes into thinking about something like that versus thinking about President Trump and his press conferences or his, you know, rallies? Is there a difference in how we approach that, given the obligation we have to our constituency, as Jay was saying, our constituency?
Well, in some ways, she is similar to President Trump in that she is really, she is a celebrity now and has a very strong social media presence. And so what she says on social media becomes news more than maybe other of our Congress men and women or our senators. She's so active, and she makes, and I'll put this in quotes, news more often than others because of that. But what we do is we read it, we take it in, and then we decide, is this something we're going to pursue? What does happen is the national media throws her into the spotlight too, or she does via Twitter, and then we're in this reaction mode. And as journalists, I mean, we continue to do our work, which is We do pursue her for interviews. And as you said, Angela had her last week. I think every one of our teams in the newsroom have requested interviews for months and months. We pursue documents to get the truth. How can we substantiate what's going on in her life, in her personal life? Is that news? You know, we've had extensive conversations about that. We don't abandon our journalistic process and principles for anyone. So in the case of Ilhan Omar, we apply the same standards to her. She just becomes news more often than the others. And I think part of the challenge is, at some point, is this news anymore? And is it helpful to the audience? And in some cases, it may not be. And we need to move on to something else.
Have you, I know you've been in news a long time. Last question, how would you characterize the changes that you've seen in journalism?
I guess I would say there are days when I'm still hopeful that we can get to a situation where people will listen to each other. But when I actually go outside of the newsroom, I talk to people and I might spout facts or talk about stories. And when I approach, even talking to someone else, I think that they're not going to listen to what I have to say anyway because they've already made up their mind. So when I'm inside a newsroom, I'm feeling more hopeful, oddly or interestingly. And when I'm outside, I find that I'm in a much more of a challenging situation. And I want to, frankly, avoid political conversations. And I'm a news person, an informed news person, and I want to run away from it.
I'd like to bring back in Jay Rosen, media critic, writer, and professor of journalism at New York University, and Mia Parrish, who's also had a long career in journalism, including being publisher at the Arizona Republic and the Kansas City Star. Jay, to Nancy's point, how do you feel about that?
Well, I'm pessimistic that we're going to be able to get out of the current cycle soon. And the main reason I'm pessimistic is that the current president has been trying to do something that other presidents, at least in the modern era, have basically never done. We're used to presidents who win election and then try and persuade the people who didn't vote for him to still support him despite the fact that he was not their candidate. And the presidential approval rating emerged as a kind of scoreboard to tell us how well he was doing. Presidents that had higher approval ratings than their share of the vote were being successful in reaching out to the rest of the country. And President Trump has a different idea about how to govern and how to get reelected, which is to divide the country, polarize politics, and try and claim the bigger half of a polarized nation. This is a method of governance and a political style that we haven't seen before, and it is supposed to create that hopeless conversation where people dismiss your view before you've even completed your sentence. That is the intended outcome of that political style. And that is such a challenge to not only business as usual, but to democratic norms of behavior, that it's difficult for anyone to figure out what to do. The Republican Party behind Trump, they haven't figured out what to do. The Democratic Party is spinning its wheels trying to respond to this style. The press doesn't know what to do. People in the permanent bureaucracy are often under attack as well. And so in a way, the president has sort of like frozen the whole political system in the image of his own political style.
If you have an idea about how we should approach this, you can call me 800-242-2828 or 651-227-6000. And I'm on Twitter at Tiffany Hansen. And Nancy, I'm going to let you go. You're welcome to stay if you want to hang on. Do you?
Sure.
Why not?
Sure. Why not?
And to Twitter, Amy says, I'm a recent graduate of journalism school, and I'm wondering how we as reporters can garner the trust of readers in today's climate. Any tips for new reporters to establish that trust right away? And I'm going to toss that to you, Mia.
I talk a lot about taking the high road, which has been increasingly difficult, right? You've been in this news cycle for a really long time, and it's pretty exhausting, and it's unprecedented. and not taking the bait and pacing yourself in this, I think you gain trust by earning that trust. And as Nancy and Jay both said, it's increasingly difficult, and it does take a lot of work. It takes a lot of work inside the newsroom and outside of the newsroom, and being a good egg at the beginning and the end of the day is really important. And I understand why a lot of journalists you're seeing some of the cracks start to happen in that. Part of that, I think, comes from that pressure. The media organizations are under a lot of pressure financially. The organizations themselves, at the same time that the institution is, and social media puts increasing pressure on that. And we really haven't talked about it, but those external forces of the technology are exacerbating this in ways that I think we knew, but we're not really not expecting. You know, that there are the bad actors that help accelerate that the notion and the misinformation and the disinformation that we're dealing with. So it's harder. It's just not impossible. It's just a lot harder.
I'd like to bring in Justin in St. Paul. Good morning, Justin.
Good morning.
Yeah, what did you have to add here?
Well, I just thought that the problem we are encountering today about facts in the news is that there are people who want their belief to be fact. They want to reinforce their subculture and not the overall culture for everybody. And we are nice and we want everyone to be heard. And this is really harming what is true. I don't think that it's okay to believe that the earth is flat. I think a journalist should have no bias to view the world. Their job is to inform the public of what is objectively true. They should not give voice to things that are provably false.
So, Jay, you've brought up and others have brought up this notion of a truth sandwich. Can you explain that for us? And I wonder if that might get at what Justin is concerned about.
The truth sandwich is a method recommended by George Lakoff, who's an academic who studies political behavior and political psychology. And it says that when a public figure states something false, instead of repeating what the false claim was and then debunking it, you should start with what the situation is, like illegal entries at the border have actually gone down. And then you bring in the distortion or the misstatement or the lie in the middle, and then you restate what the truth is. So instead of giving publicity or further traction to a false claim, you start with the truth, you mention the false claim, you repeat the truth. And this is a way that you can report on false statements without adding to their force.
Nancy, do we do that here?
The truth sandwich.
Yeah. Nancy, do we do that here?
You know, National Public Radio does a lot of that. In fact, I was on a panel just last week where I was with the standards and practices lead for National Public Radio out of D.C., and they talk a lot about exercising the truth sandwich, correct. For NPR News, we have done it with some of our political stories. It's not sort of a narrative that we have going in the newsroom every day, but again, you know, we're covering Minnesota and the region versus covering day-to-day President Trump and some of the challenges.
Mia, we've talked about these very distinct beliefs and opinions that are causing a lot of divisiveness. And I'm wondering, after the 2016 election, how do you think the media did in terms of reporting the views of a large segment of the U.S. population that voted for our president, who were disaffected, angry? Do you think there was a moment when we had this sort of collective realization that maybe we didn't do such a good job on reporting what they were thinking and wanting and needing?
Yes, I think we were not awesome, frankly. We were not awesome. We were, you know, there was a fair amount of arrogance and sadly ignorance, I think, on our part that you know, there were polls that we believed, there were facts that we thought were true, and came into it with a lens that was our the past way that we did business, and we were dealing with a wholly new animal. You know, the way that the president approaches the press and truth was not something that we were prepared for. And so, you know, we were using our old techniques and practices for how we covered that. And we didn't do a great job going into it. We didn't do a great job of covering it. And I'm not sure that we've learned very quickly in the last couple of years how to adapt and adopt new ways of approaching that that are more effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jay, I wonder, you know, the Washington Post said, you know, we need to report and reflect on the interests and values of the people who voted for President Trump. And to Mia's point, we're still not great at that, are we? Or are we getting better?
I don't think the 2016 debacle has been reflected on enough. I don't think practice has changed in response to that utter failure and disaster. I think there's still a tendency to hang on to the way journalists do things because that's what they know, and that's also where they have consensus. One of the reasons news reporting doesn't change that much is that you need large teams of journalists to be on the same page about what we're doing here, and things like he said, she said journalism, trying to steer right down the middle, are well-entrenched practices that everybody knows about. Yes, there is a challenge there of listening to Trump country in a way that didn't happen in 2016. I don't think it's so much that the voices of Trump supporters have to be more prominent. We know what the Trump ideology is. I like to use a distinction C.R.A. Mills drew in the 1950s between troubles and issues. Troubles are the things that bother people in their daily lives, the things they talk about with their families at night over the kitchen table, the things that are worrying to them in their lives. Issues are what the political system makes so that we can win elections and generate support. What journalists need to do is understand people's troubles well enough that they can know why they would vote for somebody like President Trump. And that certainly didn't happen in 2016, but there were lots of other problems in 2016 too, like an obsessive focus on Hillary Clinton's emails and the way in which Donald Trump successfully gamed the system by being entertaining and controversial and sort of a spectacle. So there were lots of problems that led to that result, and I don't think we've seen the period of reflection that we need to improve that.
Nancy, we are a purple state. We had a lot of folks vote for President Trump in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Have we gotten better at understanding their troubles and reporting on that? And has that come about or not? Based on reflection that we've very purposeful reflection that we've had here in the newsroom?
I think the first step in change is awareness. And I think that, yes, we're aware. The challenge is getting to voters to all different types of voters, not just Trump supporters or Republicans or disenfranchised Democrats, or it's how do we reach into communities that we don't know what we don't know them? Where are we trying to make inroads? And I will tell you, one of the very basic things we've done in the newsroom is to make some relationships in groups and communities that we didn't ever hear about in 2016. And one of the really interesting revelations, and it's tiny, but several people after 2016 said, you know, if you drove around Minnesota at all and looked, there were many Trump signs in people's yards. And reporters or others just didn't take note. And sort of understanding what that was about would have been a helpful step. So, I think the awareness is there. the small steps have been made. What I can say is we're working to be more reflective of many views and not just a few views.
Jay, we have just a few minutes left, and I want to touch on this, the future, where we're headed. Is news in general headed toward more opinion and less fact, or is it a combination of the two, or can we expect people to differentiate even between opinion and fact anymore?
Well, it's very hard to predict what direction we're going in because we're in a period of global tumult on these kinds of questions. But what I would like to see happen is for journalists to find a way, and so far they haven't, that they can, instead of saying we have no view, we have no stake, we have no perspective here, we have no assumptions, instead I would like to see journalists sort of reduce some of the tension here and admit that they're always coming from somewhere when they're reporting, and yet they also furnish us with facts. They are coming from somewhere, but they also tell us what they found in their reporting. And I think this combination of saying, yeah, here's where we're coming from, but this is what we found in our reporting, you may be coming from somewhere else, is less of a kind of challenge or dare to critics. And if journalists could evolve into that kind of approach, I think it would create less divisiveness. But instead, the natural reaction to criticism is to hang on even tighter to he said, she said, both sides, you figure it out. And that pattern is it producing this kind of divisiveness.
Mia, quickly, are we good at even explaining to people, as Jay said, where we're coming from?
No. I mean, I think in answer to your original question, I think credible, transparent journalism has never been more important and necessary. The idea that opinion has become weaponized, you know, or like if you have an opinion and I disagree with you, then I want to kill you. And nobody believes us that we have no point of view. You know, everybody or that we don't have a view at all. So they're not going to believe you. They're not going to trust you. If we continue on this path where we just keep saying, trust me, I don't have any opinion. I'm just telling you things. That transparency that is so vital, and we say it's so vital, has somehow taken a back seat. You know, we've gotten less and less good about saying where it is we're coming from, why it is that we're reporting the story, what that looks like, what the ramifications are, what the context is. It's been harder. I think NPR does a really good job of that, actually. And I say it not just because I'm on NPR, but but that transparency, like who the reporters are, who's paying for what, where this is coming from, you know, what partnerships there are. I think that's just more and more important in explaining the difference between opinion analysis and pure play news.
Mia, thank you so much. Mia Parrish is a former publisher of the Arizona Republic and the Kansas City Star. She currently teaches at Arizona State University. Thanks for joining me, Mia.
Thanks for having us.
Jay Rosen, journalism professor and director at the Studio 20 program at NYU. Jay, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Nancy Cassett, our executive director of news and programming right here at Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.